Before beginning, I thought it would be very nice to show you quite a famous small statue, small by Egyptian standards, it's large by our standards, of the king, very young, but it was not constructed when he was very young. It was constructed later. And it's to the deity Horon, who is protecting him and, in a sense, providing him with birth. It's famous because it is a game with Egyptian hieroglyphs and the presence of the king, in a sense, as a child, and with the sun disk for Re on top. So it forms what is called a rebus or a rebus of the king's name. But it is a useful place to start because we don't meet Ramesses as this. And I think of those of you that know quite a lot about his life, the background of the king, the Battle of Kadesh is always considered up to the top of the accomplishments, or shall we say, attempted successes of the pharaoh. He wasn't totally successful, to say the least. He wasn't successful, to be honest. He failed in his attempt. But he had produced, or arranged to have produced, quite a number of inscriptions. In particular, one lengthy one that I will use here, the so-called poem. It isn't a poem. It is a narrative composition that runs quite extensively and was later reproduced, or at least copies were made, soft copies in hieratic on papyri that I think were read more than once, more than many times, in fact, in Egypt. For the battle itself, we all know, or most of us know, that it was an accomplishment in his second campaign. He had an earlier one in his fourth year, but in his fifth year as pharaoh, it is the famous Battle of Kadesh. And the real issue comes, I have a blank slide here, with the northern march of the king. He's going to Kadesh. He's going to be outside of the city, as we now recognize to be typical. He's going to wait for a battle to occur. He did not expect that the main enemy of the Egyptians, the Hittites, would be there. He expected a battle of the coalition, or at least a group of Syrian potentates. The king of Kadesh in particular, would be engaging him on the open field outside. There you see, as we go up to the north, he's not interested in these directions, but this is given as a hypothesis, a reasonable one. You note that in this hypothesis, he goes inland from Megiddo back to the Mediterranean and then up into the northern regions of Syria. There you see that we actually have gone extensively to the north of what Tutmosis III did. As for his reasons for going to the west of the city of Kadesh, I think the assumption that we must make, as we do always, is that the king is not going to attack the city. He's going to see first if the city is opposed to him. In this case, Kadesh was on the Hittite side, so automatically it was an enemy. The gates would be shut. That means there would have been a battle. There would have been expectation of a battle. He was in sight of the city across the river Orontes, which itself is an interesting fact because he's not outside the city walls. He didn't intend to be outside the city walls. And what's even more interesting, as many of us know, he did not know the presence of the enemy Hittites who were there. He expected to meet his enemy in combat on the day immediately following his arrival. So the day of arrival where he sets his camp up is not the day that the king expected a battle to occur. But that is when the battle actually occurred, to his surprise. One can go through various numbers. I noticed that some scholars decreased the number of troops and chariots to a minimal. 200, for example, is one offer given from approximately 15,000. On the other hand, from Kadesh, we know that the enemy had 1,900 chariots, and the Egyptians, I assume, more than that. So the numbers, I don't believe, that Ramesses met and used were all of the enemy totals or all of the Egyptian totals. And I think in the poem, we are given a grand total of 3,500 chariots from the Egyptian records. It should be pointed out that our only records are the Egyptian. We have a brief comment afterwards that by the Hittites, from the king or to be king himself, that the Hittites had won, and I would agree with that totally. From the Egyptian side, that aspect is not stressed as much as the heroic attitude of Ramesses II. And it's that word, the adjective heroic and the noun from which it is derived, hero, that I think is my conclusion in interpreting him. Because everything moves to his attack against a surprised enemy charge into his camp, and is standing up to the enemy and his fighting to the enemy and his discussions with the god Amun to the god, to his father, at the battle, in the field, in the camp itself. Here you can see a general map, as I say, and by now you know I'm somewhat suspicious, but perhaps the region of Kadesh provided here is a bit better for you, because it provides the topography of the rivers, a bit of the heights, as you can see, and the like. It's relatively modern. Kadesh, by the way, as a discussion point for scholars, has again become the hallmark of modern research. Within the last 5 or so years, there have been 3 or 4 major studies on Kadesh. There you can see going up to what is called Old Kadesh and Kadesh itself, and there's a dispute a bit on that. Ramesses is across the river to the to the west. The Hittite king is across the river to the east. They naturally, in a sense, balance one another. What the Hittite king, whose name is Muwatallis, did is he hid himself, provided he knew what he was doing, behind the city, and he waited for the Egyptian troops to go north. The Hittite king had not planned at all for this event. The event unrolled, so to speak. And in the true sense, the battle is one that is not planned, not predicted, that, as I say, rolls out or suddenly occurs because of the momentary nature of the weakness of the Egyptian army. The Egyptian army, to remind some of you, divided itself or was divided into 4 parts. The king is at the head, as I stressed before. He's at the division number 1, the first division. And the remaining divisions are on the line, southwards. So the Hittite king behind Kadesh would have seen Ramesses come up. I say seen, and perhaps that's a bad word, would have been alerted to the fact by his spies, by his scouts, that the king was going northwards. He had already had spies that were sent out earlier to provide the Egyptians with false information. But the unraveling of these events is quite remarkable because, as I said earlier, it was unpredictable. I think the Battle of Megiddo that I discussed last Tuesday, you can say, yes, that was predictable. In fact, it was predictable to all and all on any side. Here it was not. So Ramesses decided he hadn't planned to fight, but his tactical thoughts must have been to arrive close to Kadesh, but not across the river on the Orontes to the east. Set up his own camp there to the north of Kadesh on the west side of the river. His 3rd and 4th division were positioned close to the ford across the river. He had a 5th division coming from the west. It is not yet on the map, entering the combat zone. So although he was in his camp with 1 division, he had a 2nd division not close by that was slightly to the north of him. And finally, he has a 4th division to the south. These are speculations, and even for myself, I noted that the timing becomes very tight. For example, one scholar, it happens to be Kenneth Kitchen, has a 1.5 to 2 hour period of time in which the spies of the Hittites go back to their king, which is very close and very tight, to me too tight for the unraveling of the events. I see the unraveling as suddenly occurred spontaneously. Here is, of course, Ramesses there. Let me get him. He's in a nice red arrow there. He's parked there, so to speak, as a car. He set up the camp, and in the pictures of which I shall show you later on, the camp is peaceful itself. The chariots are there all stacked up, I guess like a row of seats here. The horses are separate. The donkeys are separate. The bullocks or the oxen are separate. There is a relaxation scene that is provided for you, the viewer, to say everything is fine, and then the Hittites attack. Thus, the king had enough time to settle a camp, which is something that does not occur very frequently, and in fact takes a long amount of a few hours. So all of the arrivals that we have here, he arrives first as a city in southern Syria. He gets to the south of Kadesh. He arrives south of Shaptuna, not far from the town, and finally goes to the northwest of Kadesh. The text itself, the so-called poem, will give us these points, and thus we can actually provide a slim chronological framework. But when it becomes hours and then half hours or 15 minutes, it's very hard to actually know, are our reconstructions correct or not? But for the king himself, as he depicts his reactions, he did not expect the events. The further intelligence that was given to him indicated that the Hittites were there across the river, but not yet was it given to him the information that the king of the Hittites, Muwatallas, had moved his chariots across. Thus, we enter into an even second important point of the type of battle, reminding you it's unexpected. In a sense, it's like a film that's just being made, the first take, as it occurs in English, the first version that will be changed again and again when the second and third and fourth versions occur. Muwatallas sends his chariots, only his chariots, across the river. He bashes into one of the divisions, the second division. Here's a nice map, and the Hittite attack number one. He wants to get to the camp as quickly as possible. He sends no infantry. There are no backup troops. Everything depends upon the chariots, and which was brought up in the last lecture. How do they fight? The terrain? What is the type of land that they have to run through or travel through? Into the camp, he swings around, and you notice the swing is very nicely done here. The second division is caught, according to this map here, which is true, and the Hittites have to come up. They actually swing further to the north than this. And there's the fifth division coming here as a positive, not as a negative, let me add, contribution. Thus, the king finds himself attacked solely by chariots. And again, I find this, in a sense, ironic, because the elite warriors of New Kingdom Egypt were the chariot warriors. Everyone who was important was a charioteer. You were on the chariot and you fought from the chariot. So the battle itself is the most perfect of all battles for the elite. It's the one that is highly prized, I am sure, in literature. And the Egyptians did stress the point that it was all chariots at this point. For the reaction of the king would have to be the same. He's not going to use his local troops in the camp simply to attack chariots. The further information then goes, and is connected to the following parameters that you can perhaps see here. Muwatallas had earlier moved into North Syria, but there is no way that any administrator or even a scout could have known the plans of the enemy. In this case, although Muwatallas, the Hittite, knew something, quite a lot, about the Egyptians, the other side did not. The Egyptians knew nothing about the location of the Hittites. Now, you can blame the pharaoh for crass stupidity, but as the bulletin puts it, to heap opprobrium upon his officials in Asia is one thing, yet it misses the logistic background of combat. Ramesses blames two groups, his officials, Egyptians, and the local, if you will, potentates or governors in Asia, for the fact he was not informed. We can say equally that his own spies or scouts had not done an excellent job. But I think when you deal with warfare in battle, in combat, it's often very difficult to know where the enemy is, even if the enemy is close by. The term that is used in parlance, modern parlance, the so-called fog of war, doesn't mean real fog that I am now talking about, but it means the lack of information. But in a sense, Ramesses II did have the problem of not having any information. The fog of war was totally preventing him from allowing any understanding of what was going on. Now, the deception of the Hittite king, I think, has to be linked with his daring conception, and it is daring, to send only his chariots south of Kadesh and across the ford. But he had already allowed or ignored the first division. He could have gone through the first division, could he not? The first and second and third and fourth divisions, we will assume, are roughly the same size, 5,000 maximum number of soldiers. The first may have been the best. Probably it was. It was the elite of the elite. But it would be very successful, would it not, if Mu'tallas had sent his chariots through, as this picture has, not the division of prey, but at the Egyptian camp where the king's division of Ammon was, and he didn't. There can be raised questions of that. Did he actually know that the king was there coming up, or was he too partially blinded by the fog of war? And when information was given to him by his scouts, then he moved. I tend to think that's the other case. And that's why I say, if you want to think, how long did it take for all of these little events to be put together? I think between 15 minutes and 30 minutes. Everything is very, very sharp. Everything is tight, constricted to such a degree that, in a sense, success or failure depends upon an instant decision, not waiting and deciding what to do. This is not Thutmose III at Megiddo, who has the time to do it. So you have to keep that in mind of what actually happened. Here is the Hittite attack on number two. For what happened, and I can say in terms of the distances, is that the first attack was to get rid of the second division, but it didn't stop there. Obviously, Mu'tallas had instructed his troops to cut through, to slice through, and that's the Egyptian phrase or word, to slice like a sharp knife, going right through the chariots, but to continue on and don't stop and do anything with the second division. Forget about the few troops you may have lost, forget about the success smashing or slicing through the second division. Leave that half-defeated, immobilized division alone. Get to the camp as quickly as possible. And in terms of the distance, if you wanted to stretch it out, you have about 2 kilometers at most. And with the reconstruction, we can now apply, I think, more carefully our prognosis. Remembering to go back, there was my first phase, and there I'm moving into the second phase, where you have the chariots going through the division of prey. The first phase is the king settling down. So I think we can actually now provide some parameters as to the Egyptian side. Ramesses was not known to be exactly where he was, as we now know later, by the Hittites. Mu'tallas had not the time to dispatch his chariots against the first division when they were marching. This may have been dependent on the first, for I am now arguing that Mu'tallas was also partially ignorant of the Egyptians. Both sides, of course, don't know precisely what the other side is doing. And this has to be taken into consideration about the daring attempt to send, with my black arrow providing here, at least the various chariots going across. Only the chariots are going across. Of course, the soldiers, speaking parenthetically, would take time to march, would they not? But it isn't also a lack of infantry in the battle. It's a lack of really archers on the ground shooting arrows. So it isn't that type of battle that actually came to place. In the poem, it specifically notes the Egyptian side that Mu'tallas had positioned his chariots behind Kadesh. I have to say that I am taking the Egyptian side. One must remember that the whole plans of the Hittites, whatever they did, where they were, what they wished, is from only the Egyptian point of view. How they actually could assume that all the chariots were there or portions of them were there is another issue I don't wish to go into, and I actually cannot conclude. I also do not assume that Mu'tallas had any idea of the precise nature of the army which Ramesses He didn't know about the fifth division, I am positive. And I suspect that although he saw the second and knew the first division existed, the third and the fourth, perhaps yes or no. So if I set up both kings, Rameses and Muwatallis side by side, Rameses knew nothing about his enemy's position. Muwatallis knew nothing previously about the Egyptian position. And there we have always the problem of military intelligence. And I give a very good example in the Napoleonic Wars of it, where you have to be sure what is going on, and often you're not. Rameses was deceived by the so-called Shasu Bedouin, or spies, and that was a fatal error. But Muwatallis had purposely sent to Shasu to reconnaissance and to meet up with Rameses. So the Hittite king had sent spies ahead, not Hittites, not anyone directly associated with his troops, but ones who would not be perceived to be enemies, locals, shall we say. Rameses kept the internal structure of his army intact. There were no alterations, division 1, 2, 3, 4, with 5 coming in passes. There's no reason. And likewise, I assume that Muwatallis did the same, keeping his troops hidden at Kadesh. Rameses avoided moving to the east. He must have had seen few, if any, enemy troops outside of Kadesh. I say he must have. I wonder if that's true anymore. Muwatallis avoided showing his hand at first. Rameses set up the camp. Previously, the Hittites had set up the camp. What I'm doing is placing one column of the Egyptian parallel to one column of the Hittites. The timing of both logistic dispositions is unclear. This is my problem, and I think one can't go too far and too strict in trying to find out what happened. Rameses sent out reconnaissance as soon as he camped, and that has to be stripped. That's proper procedure. Muwatallis actually did the same. Both sides participated in the so-called fog of war. Intelligence of the exact location of the enemy was, as to be expected, imprecise, delayed, and often blank. I think Rameses' choice of his camp position would have allowed enough space for the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th division. Muwatallis' choice was equally well designed behind Kadesh, but outside the city, not inside of it. He has a large number of troops. They can't go in the city. They have to be fed. So too the horses and the like. Hence, a chariot attack was almost predictable of what would happen. But neither opponent, to stress once more to you, had ever planned the battle. Rameses expected the next day, the Hittite king engaged suddenly by chance, with a degree of preparation to be sure, but ultimately by chance moving his troops in this direction across the river. But if that didn't happen, he would have, this is the Hittite king, he would have probably have expected a battle over here, or certainly over here, if it was to be a quote-unquote set piece. And that, I think, is significant. Owing to the discovery that Rameses' 2nd division was exposed, Muwatallis sends his troops there. The result being Rameses was exposed, and Muwatallis must have tried to achieve an immediate and rapid destruction of Rameses in the camp. Because once those troops go through the 2nd division and reach the camp of Rameses, everything then depends upon the success there. So we arrive finally at the camp. There are many, many uncertainties, I could say. One can ask me. I consider quite a number that Muwatallis hoped that he was undiscovered, if that eventually it happened not to be. He didn't expect the arrival of the 5th Division. So here, too, you have to add other facts. And in fact, when you come to the actual battle, here's Kadesh with the 5th Division coming. I use a strong red arrow here. The Egyptians have one division at the camp and the 2nd division coming. Those divisions have chariots as well as archers, foot soldiers. The Hittites have many, perhaps, divisions of chariots, but only chariots, you see. That's all they have. And they've gone through and cut through one division, but that takes time and allows the king to, of course, to ultimately regroup his troops in the camp. For there is a degree of time that has elapsed. Here is the additional troops provided by the Red Arrow. So the actual encounter at the camp may not have been, I leave that open, I have not provided any written position on it, but perhaps with the two divisions present on the Egyptian side, it would have been impossible for the Hittites to succeed at the camp. Again, it's a bet, it's a calculation, it's an immediate decision on the part of the Hittite king to move quickly, but he's impeded by the second division that slows down the arrival of the chariots at the home base or at the bivouac or at the camp of Ramesses II. So the time elements, you see, again, become important. 15 minutes to cut through the second division may be true. I would like it a little longer, but 15 minutes, you say, gives 15 minutes to the Egyptians, who already know that the chariots are crossing the river. Enough time, you see, to get ready. Ramesses did have enough time to get ready. That's the basic argument that we go through to the arrival and finally to the important phase of the king. Now, in this portion of the Egyptian account, the so-called poem, the narrative ceases, the description of the battle's development ceases, and the king implores or pleads to his god Amun. And this portion of the text has received a lot of recent study. It was generally ignored by military historians, saying, well, Ramesses is crying out to his father Amun for help. I'd like to point out that he cries out also to his two horses after his father Amun. He does not cry out to his troops to help, it's his two horses, because he's going to engage in a chariot-based warfare. It's a scene that a movie director would be saying, yes, hero, heroine, and open the door comes the mustached man. In a film, shall we say, of 1916, in a silent film, occurring. Ramesses has the time to develop. And how did he actually call out to his father? Was it real? I claim yes, but not in the words that are given in the account. Because all of the Egyptian pharaohs brought with them a statue of Amun, a portable one. Portable, you just carry it. You just be that big. And in the scenes, you have a central portion of the Egyptian camp in which the god Amun, or a figure, is depicted. The central portion is where the king is, and he has a shrine attached to his tent. So I do believe that Ramesses went to the god. And the interesting thing is that you have an intervention of the deity, but it's purely in the mind of the pharaoh. Let me be precise. Ramesses calls out to Amun, his father, explains what's happening, really, cries out in shock. He's isolated, he's all alone. He cannot depend upon his troops, and really he cannot depend upon his administrators. The god actually takes him by the arm, I know, so by the hand to be more precise, in the account of Ramesses II. But this is not meant that you saw, or the king actually physically was this way. You're expecting somehow the physical presence of the deity. This is a reconstruction, an imaginary one to be sure, of the king's attitude in battle. It's often said that this lengthy, remarkable prayer, it's often called, I don't know if it's really a prayer, but let me call it a supplication to the deity, out loud it appears to be, asking him for his help in the need, in the time of need, is a direct response of the Egyptian cultural elements, which are supposedly pietistic, very religious at this time. I think it's more than that. I am not worried about the religious nature of the king. If caught, as he was, Ramesses has two choices. He has to fight, he has to get his troops to battle, and he obviously has to pray for success or plead for success to his deity. So to me, it is not necessary to stress, as other scholars have done, the religious component in the middle of the narrative as much as has been done in the past. I just say that and leave it alone. But It's interesting to note this section, and go back to my previous lecture on the 11th of this month, and note Tutmosis III's speech to his troops. And here is Rameses II's speech to his God, not to his troops. There is no encouraging of them in the composition. He would have had to do so. He would definitely have had to do so. So what he was faced with, and why we have this lengthy, internal, remarkable, religiously oriented, but highly emotional speech of the king, is what the king wanted to give to us. For the composition depicts him as a hero, but depicts him also in this link with his father much more strongly than Tutmosis III did. There are portions in the Tutmosis III Megiddo battle that you could say, yes, he does connect himself with Amun, but it is not significant, and it is not on the day of battle, in the morning on the 21st of the day of battle at Megiddo, where Rameses II, it's clearly in the afternoon, early afternoon, and it's therefore on the day of battle. By chance, unexpectedly, he calls out to his father, God. He does not ignore the fifth division, but by himself, he stresses the chariot organization and the operations that are given in the text. Now, I think that there. Here is the march I've taken, not from the latest publication, the Kadesh March, which is very useful for us, if you remember my first lecture, and partially the second, as it shows you how the actual divisions would have marched. The infantry, you can see, are in the middle, being protected by chariots, troops, on one side, the other, front and rear. So front, rear, left and right. And so when the Hittites came through in their chariots, they would have come through this way. And it's the infantry that would have really suffered the most, because how could they actually escape if the Hittite chariots came this way? They'd have to run outside of their protective barrier of Egyptian, you see, chariot support. So I suspect the infantry in the second division suffered more than would have been normal. That's how the divisions were strung out. And this is very nice because this is simply the battle before. It's the battle accounts, but it's before the actual encounter at the camp. At the camp, here we have it. I've taken one version in Luxor for you. Let me recapitulate, because I said something about this. First, this is the camp. And that's the central portion with the king's tent, and as I would claim, a tent or a subsidiary portion of the king's tent in which the statue of Amun was, the portable Amun was. You can see over here, let me go on my thing, that the donkeys are there, outside, they're eating, that the whole camp has shields protecting it, that there's four entranceways, logically, and one main entranceway, that the horses are lined up, as I said before, like the chairs here, but separated or decoupled from the chariots. They would have come into camp partially decoupled, that you have a whole group of horses here, plus the lion that Rameses appears to have taken with him, and Egyptian pharaohs, not only Rameses, but his father and a further pharaoh that we shall not meet, do take, apparently, a pet lion with them. I leave it to you. It isn't a statue. There are the chariots, see over here, in rows, listed up. There are various, if you will, granaries, although that's not really the right word. There's the supplies of food and the like, and guards. You might notice that the battle is beginning on the upper side, the top side here, with the troops fighting. And you might notice that the fighting is chariot-based, see, up here. The depiction includes more than one event. You have, say, hour 3 o'clock, hour 3:30, hour 4 o'clock. Over here, for those interested, is, of course, the next portion that is connected to the actual attack. The king is receiving the information, and he's getting ready to go out in battle. So how you would read it is interesting. I'd read it from here first, here, and then finally here. Bottom to top again. Over here are simply additional troop movements, but you notice, wow, horses, mainly horses. And even here on the frieze, the horses and the troops that are guarding him and the like. It's useful to point out, even in this early 1920s diagram, the pictorial nature of the account. You notice, at least in this, you have the beginnings of the attack on the camp, and that's really what we only receive in the pictorial or artistic representation. We only see the attack on the camp. We don't see the attack on his second division. Why? Because the king is there. Everything is surrounding the king. So this is what we have. We don't see him, though, equally, talking, praying, imploring on his feet, on his knees, to his deity. We don't see the deity. There is no miraculous presence, such as the hand of God coming in, or a smoky thing coming in from a bush, and the like. There is no direct involvement in the pictorial evidence of the religious nature that Rameses is discussing in the so-called poem and the actual events. It's as if it's split. And thus you have to go to the poem and only to the poem to try to understand even more that isolated nature of the king's, what I called, or others call, piety, although what I think is the logical outcome of a disaster. Because it was a disaster. There's no way about it. You can blame his stupidity, but let's not worry about a moral judgment and simply say it is a disaster. On the other hand, he has two divisions. Here's another version. The crisis point, I call it, plus the conference. Here again is the conference over here. The crisis point is over here, depicted. You can see the abstract nature of the camp here. You can see the attack, again, chariot-based. You can see the periphery, protective wall of the camp with the main entrance here, going up, of course, to the tent of the pharaoh. You can see partial supply areas here and troops and donkeys, and it's more happy down here. I'll leave that alone. And then again, those wanting more horses, the battle will provide it all to you because that's what it is. There are many versions, I want to say, of the pictorial evidence and many versions of the written evidence. There are five main temples alphabetically. Abu Simbel, Abydos, Karnak, Luxor, and the Ramesseum. I would like there to have been more, but they weren't. They all are, interesting enough, from Nubia to the south, but relatively close to Egypt, and then through the main centers of Thebes and Abydos or Abydos. That's all. Nothing, so far as I know, in the north. Not at the capital, for example, of Rameses II. Now, with Rameses asking for the aid of his father, Amun, he says that he lacks any high official. I'll now go into the list. Doesn't have them to help him. Doesn't have the charioteers to help him. Not even his own one, he doesn't mention yet, doesn't have any army soldiers or shield bearers. He actually lists the groups, not according to official military terminology in order, but lists the groups that are in the army, and thus he helps us. For example, high officials are not charioteers, army soldiers are not shield bearers, and the like. But even though no scholar takes his words as literally true, I did point out that he says, besides Amun helping him, he has his two horses, and he names the two horses. And by the way, this is crucial because this case proves that the so-called names of the horses are individual and are not the teams of the horse names. If you're interested in that, I will talk about it later with you, except that he does mention his famous one, Victorious Thebes, and then mentions the second one, the number two horse, because each chariot has two horses, Mut is happy. So you get Amun on the right side of the chariot and Mut on the left side, the god of Thebes, the father god, and the consort or wife of the father god Mut on the left side. He does stress his loneliness. Yes, he is lonely. This is not simply religious. This is real expectation. And he's stuck. Now, I point out in this presentation, just as in one portion of it, that does facing death, as Rameses II does, has encountered, mean that one's deepest religious attitudes naturally or necessarily emerge? Because those religious attitudes may not necessarily be, that's my point, as part and parcel of the culture that just comes up. It's the event that makes it come up. I leave that open to you. I am not that strongly oriented towards a pietistic nature in the composition as much as into the fear, the trepidation, and facing death. And the addition, that's why he's the hero, and I call him the hero, because there is a moment of truth. I divide up the battle into what I'll call phases, and this is more military and jargon here, with a disjunctive movement, I'm afraid. And I actually parallel to one important example of Caesar in the battle. So I'll give you them. It's quite famous, the battle. So I get my Caesar battle here. The Battle of Sabbath. They're faced by defeat. So this is in Caesar's Gallic Wars. Rameses' division is surprised. Caesar's legion division is equally hard-pressed. Then you get a moment of truth. Rameses sends for help, readies his chariot, and implores Ammon. Caesar arrives and advances his standards. The enemy are all attacking until Rameses thrusts himself into the fray of chariots. Caesar's rival makes the whole enemies are attacking stop and push back. That's phrase one. The parallel is quite remarkable. It is a military reconstruction, a literary reconstruction on both sides. Caesar doing it afterwards, at home actually in Rome, based on notes he wrote down in his tent, and Rameses II at home having someone else write it, but obviously approving it. The moment of truth is that Rameses faces a second onslaught, his personal involvement repeats itself, and in the simplified characterization, you have only two people mentioned, Rameses and his charioteer Mena. They're the only ones mentioned, no generals. Nobody else. But only two people are mentioned by name in the Caesar. I like this. Caesar and Sextilius Baculus. I brought that up because John Keegan used it separately in discussing the literary nature that we have to deal with from the ancient world and that you have to deal with it very carefully. Well, the parallel to Rameses II is there, too. The mention of the charioteer. And you could say, I would say, to be honest, his two horses by name are given there. As to the actual battle, here we have one version here, I do describe the question of how did he get his troops together, who were undoubtedly as fearful of death as he was, I think it's quite there, and discuss what it is fear in battle. But for that, the second phase, I leave it alone. Here you have, of course, the king in battle. We are now back again in the typical scenes that I gave in the first lecture on the 3rd of this month, on the 3rd of June, where I said, always the king will be the hero, in battle, alone in his chariot, using the bow, and I claim more, remember, killing humans than trying to get rid of horses. The Hittite king is over here. He's not engaged in the battle at all. And Rameses does make that difference between the Hittites never going to battle, the king himself, and the other side. But our side, yes. But our side was caught. Rameses was caught in battle. Rameses does not make, in his pictorial evidence, a differentiation between his troops in the number one division at camp and the fifth division that came in. You can't see them. It is a problem for Egyptologists who want to find out what the standards that the standard bearers used for divisions, for groups of troops. Could you recognize, say, Ammon? I think they would be a standard of a ram's head and Mut and the like and Seth, that they would be one. But you don't see the divisions, as units, as military units in the battle. However, let's go to a battle in pursuit to the Orontes, going further. You can see what he likes to do. The battle kept going on because the Hittites send more chariots. But But that's all the Hittite king can do. It's too long from his camp on the east side of the river to Ramesses' the camp on the west side of the river and north of the city of Kadesh. He can't do it, so he has to send something fast. So he sends a second group of chariots. And the warfare is, again, repeats itself. The ideal encounter of two groups of chariot troops. I have no idea of the numbers of dead on both sides, but Ramesses had the advantage of pushing or defeating the Hittite chariots so that the dead and the wounded he could check. The dead and the wounded, to remind you, are on the west side of the Orontes. So after the battle was a success, the Hittites are defeated in the field. They remain on the other side. Kadesh remains, of course, not Egyptian. Ramesses is with later troops coming. He can check up on the troops, and you have the lists of dead. They must have been lists of dead because he mentions them. Thus, we end up with the anomaly of this composition of a hero, and this is his plea that everyone now, modern Egyptologists, turn to rather than the battle itself for the pietistic religious attitude. And you can see he right there. No officers, I say high officials, no charioteers, no soldier of the army, he must mean in that foot soldier, and no shield bearer. My infantry and chariotry yielded. This is what he says. And then he's talking, you see, what is his father, Amun? And he repeats it again here. And he says what he's done for the god. But this is written later, and this is not the real plea of Ramesses. But to me it's interesting because it reveals the emotional attitude of the king alone, with the fear of death there. Everything hangs on him, but now he's at least the only king I can say to you that has experienced what these kings are supposed to experience. At the head of everyone, please, you will die eventually. It's part of life as a heroic soldier. So he's in that role, and he's therefore the hero in the battle. He goes on, see, my numerous troops deserted. All countries are against me. All countries were not against him, of course. He's alone. This is, of course, building up the tension. The chariot, no one is around. I kept shouting for them, but he knows that Ammon helps me more than 1 million troops. That's the whole thing. More than 100,000. I like this. It's something I say is a Henry Fisher thing in enumeration, if I could mention this. You start with 1 million, you go to 100,000, you go to 10,000. Downward. See, Ammon is more helpful than anyone. I have not transgressed you. And he prays in there, of course. Let me go up to our battle itself on the camp, because I do like that one at the camp. If you now want an interpretation of the king, which is what we're all after ultimately, I can roll you out the battle events as I've done. I can discuss in more detail perhaps cut through some of it and say, this I don't know, this I don't know. I can say that the king was surprised, of course. It was a classic mistake. His intelligence service didn't do him well. He trusted foreign scouts who were enemy spies. Shouldn't have done that. He should have protected himself better. But if his army is marching 1, 2, 3, 4, how, you don't march 1, 2, 3, 4. You can't bring them all together. He's stuck with this lengthy a file, right? He's a defile that he has to do. And the road determines that. The road is not that large to provide all of the troops. So even if he had some idea that there's danger ahead, would he have changed the disposition of it? No. I don't know what he would have done if he knew that the Hittites were relatively close by. Would he have actually gone that far to the west of Kadesh? I don't know, I can't say. I do know that he ends up being a hero, and he wants us to be the hero. He wants us to recognize himself as that. He's not a calculating person. He doesn't stress times of battles. He doesn't stress dispositions of troops. The tactical analysis of the warfare at Kadesh is not the hallmark, is not the orientation of the composition. The orientation is his role as hero, and he was hero, but he lost, and he lost because he had to leave, not just because he didn't win on the first day, but he did not take the city of Kadesh. So it's what is called a strategic defeat, but it is a defeat. And I know some people say, Ramesses lost, but he won. No, he didn't win, he lost. He returns home. For some reason, on the second day, of which we don't know much about, they must have been an agreement made between the Egyptian pharaoh and the Hittite king to allow him to depart after further combat. There was further combat on the second day. But after that, he retires from the field. But he is a hero, and I think that cannot be ignored. Some scholars say the further he removed himself from the battlefield of Kadesh, from combat, the more egotistical he became, and therefore he will have his records as the great success. But anyone reading it, even his own troops, if they read the account, would recognize that they did not succeed in displacing the Hittites. They never crossed, apparently, to the east of the river Orontes, to the area where the Hittite king was. They always fought on the left. I leave that open. The battle on the second day, I don't know. It is recorded, and Ramesses is supposed to have won. I do feel that he had intact divisions 3 and 4 to give him parity, equal, if not superior, numbers of chariot troops. Muwatallis lost a lot of chariots in his first attack and in his second attack. But Ramesses II has to go back again and again as well. Therefore, if you wanted me to conclude describing him, and I stress not describing the quality of the text of the narration, but simply of the king, of what he wants to do. Thutmose III and Ramesses II are provided here. Undisguised as Ramesses' self-portrayal. It is a self-portrayal coming out. But Thutmose's face of battle differs considerably from Ramesses'. I fully agree with the criticism that might be raised that I am overemphasizing the contingent. After all, did not Ramesses face destruction at Kadesh? Why Thutmose III faced no defeat, but just a choice, a conundrum. The dilemmas given to Thutmose III were very different than that given to Ramesses II, of course. How to get to the goal is Thutmose's point. How to get out of the camp and defeat the enemy chariots is Ramesses II. But working within the scenarios does allow us moderns to take an analysis of that, that the poem of Kadesh is an excellent piece of literature, and it does not, as literature, detract from the ultimate theme, which is of the king as hero. So I conclude then as the heading, Ramesses II, King as Hero. Thank you.